Generating traffic and sales can be a challenge for online merchants. But selling on the Walmart Marketplace puts your products in front of millions of customers who shop on Walmart.com. And right now, sellers who join Walmart Marketplace can save up to 50% on referral and fulfillment fees for the first 90 days. So get started today. Head over to marketplace.walmart.com/savings. That's marketplace.walmart.com/savings.
Welcome to E-Commerce Conversations, a podcast by Practical E-Commerce.
What is going on, Internet? Eric Manholz back again with another E-Commerce Conversations. Hope all is going well on the other side of the Internet. On the other side of the Internet from me, Nathan. What's up, man?
What's good, Eric? Happy to be here.
Oh, man, this has been a podcast a year in the making. I've been a longtime admirer of your work and super stoked to have you on here and kind of share some lessons that you've learned. But I wanted to give our listeners a quick rundown of who you are, what you've done, and some of the stuff you've built.
Sure. Yeah. I'm the creative director at Allbach Communications, a small advertising firm and the most known on the internet for doing the Steakums Twitter stuff over the past 4.5 years or so. I recently stopped just this past December. So that would be in 2021. It's about, about half a year ago or so. And yeah, so I do social media, copywriting, writing. I do a lot of freelance writing for different publications about internet culture and brand personification and internet history. I do a lot of like chronology of just kind of various events from subcultures on YouTube and Reddit and different platforms. So yeah, a little bit all over the place, but yeah, I'm an internet culture guy and specialize in social media.
Do you have a podcast as well? Is that still active or?
It's not super active. I did like, I think 2 episodes last year. It sort of started out as just kind of means of having conversations with interesting people. And then it kind of tapered off as I got really busy with work, but no, there's still some good evergreen stuff on it. It's called What's Really Good with Nathan Allbach. But yeah, maybe I'll get back into it at some point.
Yeah, I'm sure the content's pretty evergreen, right?
I mean, most of it, So, some dated references in there, I'm sure. But
just take you down a trip of memory lane, I suppose.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think I fell into your work when Steakums called out Neil deGrasse Tyson. Is that how you pronounce his name?
I think it's deGrasse Tyson, but yeah, okay. Yes, that's the guy. Yeah, we had a beef.
It brings me pleasure to mispronounce his name then.
Absolutely. Yeah, he was like, yeah, he's just, he's become, it's funny how around that period, it was kind of, the tide was kind of turning with him. Like, I feel like he was a internet darling for a pretty long time on, at least in most social media circles. And he's one of these guys who just posts a lot of factoids and, just kind of bizarre science stuff. And sometimes it's useful. A lot of times it's really esoteric and kind of pretentious feeling. And yeah, he posted one of those moments, like, I guess that was in early or mid 2021 about I think the tweet was something like, the good thing about science is that it's true whether or not you believe in it. And it was just kind of this like, people were feeling pretty polarized and disenfranchised by scientific institutions with COVID and everything. It was just this kind of like snooty toned tweet. And yeah, through the Steakum account, I quote tweeted it and said like, log off, bro. And then followed up with some kind of snarky commentary about like why this isn't super helpful or whatever. It started like a whole viral discourse, but it was funny to see. I didn't know that the internet was like that ready to kind of go after Neil, because I've been having this like interpersonal beef with him for the past couple of years. So it was good to see people rising up against some of that condescending content.
So, I mean, first of all, I don't think most people would have the balls to tweet that from a company account, especially one that's like not your own personal brand. You're effectively an agency for them. Mm-hmm. How do you get the permission to do something like that? And not only that, how do you get the confidence to just like hit send and I'll deal with the consequences?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it was a pretty big risk. I guess maybe like let me roll the ball back a bit, a couple years to give some context to people listening. So the Steakum account, I started operating it through our agency in like mid 2017, and they had no following at the time. It was about 1,000 inactive followers. So I just kind of started experimenting on it. They didn't take it super seriously as a platform. You know, they were mostly Facebook, Instagram at the time. So there was nothing really going on. I just kept going with it and trying to explore different subcultures, and eventually got some momentum about 6 months in and really started to roll into a couple of big viral moments that then they had to pay attention to it. And they're like, all right, there's something going on here. And it very quickly became the flagship platform that they wanted to utilize. And because they didn't really have much of a understanding in the beginning, there's a lot of trust development and like kind of, you know, just figuring out like how we want the brand voice to come across and be on that platform. And took that definitely the first year or so. It took a while of just back and forth, just testing the waters and figuring out the guardrails and all that. And eventually we came to a place of, I would just say, like mutual trust within that. And then luckily for both parties, I mean, the account continued to have these pretty big viral moments each year from 2017 through 2021, where, you know, we would be having these kind of cultural commentary threads and just speaking on issues like from Steak'em's point of view in a weird way that juxtaposed kind of semi-serious commentary with the fact that it's like this frozen meat sheet product, which is this kind of like, you know, ridiculous nature to it. So those things combined, I think, made it interesting for these viral moments. And yeah, like leading up to the Neil thing, I think that was actually the first time, the only time the brand really went quote unquote viral for being snarky, the kind of like Wendy's style stuff, which wasn't really what the voice was super known for. I mean, the voice was most known for kind of thoughtful commentary. So that was definitely a little bit of a risk, I would say. It ended up being almost exclusively positive coverage that it got from that moment, but it was still, it was, you know, I'll remember that night I was playing video games on my PC and somebody sent me that tweet from Neil and was like, hey, this, you know, this seems like something Steak'em would engage with. It seems like, you know, something that you should speak about. And I wasn't really even thinking too much of it. I looked at it on my phone and I was like, yeah, that's an annoying tweet. I'll say like, log off, bro. And thinking like, you know, we've had snarky moments through the brand, just none of them had ever hit that kind of viral zeitgeist. So as it started to kind of snowball into the evening, I was like, oh crap, like this is going to be one of those mornings at work where we're getting phone calls from media publications, which turned out to be the case, like, because people thought it was like hacked. People, you know, you have the kind of initial news coverage where people were like wanting the scoop on the story. And, you know, we just rolled with it and said, yeah, this fits in line with the kind of ethos that we try to generate through the brand, which is this thoughtful commentary about various subjects. And we felt that like Neil's approach to this topic was really just not thoughtful. So like, this is us just kind of going after him and trying to explain why we thought it was kind of backwards. So it was kind of weird, definitely more of a, I would say, a one-off encounter from the brand, but nonetheless still fit within the kind of larger persona that we had developed.
Engagement like that, because it kind of transcends just Twitter and it ends up on Reddit, it ends up on these media accounts. And that's where, you know, the huge virility, I guess, like exponential component comes from it.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and the fact that, too, it's weird how Twitter is such like a central driver for news media, because versus other platforms, I mean, you know, Reddit or TikTok or Instagram, there's just journalists and public figures and politicians and, you know, the quote unquote, like elite class, you know, they're on Twitter like 24/7. So if you can get that kind of attention snowballing on Twitter, it tends to get written about and covered within media circles. So that's really, that's been a pretty big key to the success and kind of driving that viral arm media there versus, I think, other platforms that are a little tougher to get that level of attention. Because, you know, once you get into those circles, then it becomes, like I said, this thing where, you know, if certain writers at Washington Post or BuzzFeed or, you know, certain YouTubers or whoever you're trying to attract, like if they're already following the account because they can expect kind of weird content, then they want the scoop on like that big moment as it comes in so they can get the story out or the YouTube video out or the podcast out or whatever. So it kind of became like its own gravitational pull that just built momentum over the years being on that platform.
I think in our space, most e-commerce people don't even think of Twitter as a viable marketing channel. You know, I would imagine they don't get any kind of engagement. And like any social media platform, I believe you kind of got to be a user to understand it. But what are some of the things on Twitter that a person needs to think about as they build out their account and build out their brand?
Yeah, no, it's a tricky question because, I mean, rightfully so. I mean, a lot of e-commerce focuses more on like targeted, like, you know, targeting, whether it's geo-targeting or targeting certain demographics across Facebook or Google Ads and various other micro-targeting across blogs and more like brand-specific content. Like Twitter and TikTok in a similar way are like much more organically driven and they have a much more like global reach. So even as you kind of drive success on those platforms, it's really difficult to quantify, you know, where the user base is and like, is this going to, you know, have some kind of downstream effect on sales or funneling people to the right places. And it can definitely be tougher to build that out. And it's also a bigger sandbox in a lot of ways, because with a platform like Instagram, you know, you can build out a much more specific audience using those targeted ads and using those hashtags and finding that specific content to tailor an audience to. Whereas a Twitter, you're kind of just like tweeting into the void and whoever engages, engages, and it can be more difficult. You know, you might build up to 10,000 followers and of those 10,000, maybe like 7,000 aren't even where your product is sold and they don't even really care about your brand. They just like the content you're posting. There's just a lot more like variability to it, I would say. But I do think, to the point of this whole conversation, I think that when you're on Twitter, similar to TikTok, like you're kind of in the cultural zeitgeist in a way that it's much more difficult to get into on other platforms like Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, because, you know, it's news is constantly breaking, things are constantly going quote unquote viral organically. It's similar to the old internet, which just doesn't really exist on a lot more of these algorithm driven platforms. So you get your kind of foot on the ground, or you get to put your ear to the ground, I should say, as to like what is going viral in certain trends, like whether it's like a certain style of meme, whether it's a certain topic that maybe you should or shouldn't engage with, like that's kind of breaking in news. You just get a lot more closer to the kind of core of where things and how things are trending in internet culture at large. Like I would say, up until, you know, TikTok's explosion within the past couple of years, Twitter was really one of the best places in recent years to have that sense. Maybe prior to that, it was Reddit. Reddit always kind of like was the kind of like the engine for a lot of like viral content that would trickle its way into other platforms. And Reddit in a lot of ways would get stuff from 4chan or Tumblr or whatever. And now a lot of it's driving from TikTok, because obviously young people are flocking to TikTok. So, you know, I think it largely just depends on the goals of the brand and what they're willing to spend in the marketing budget to kind of build in, whether it's a cult audience or just trying to get some of that viral earned media attention. Because, yeah, like you're not going to get as targeted content or targeted of an audience built on those platforms, at least not for a while. Like you need a pretty big fronted investment of time and energy spent to kind of get to a level you might start to build out that audience, but you can get, you know, really close to the ground with what's trending at any given time. And then, like I said, because a lot of media figures spend all their time on Twitter, you've got a much better chance of reaching those people in a variety of ways versus like on Instagram, where your community might be targeted in a way that's maybe helping the bottom line with sales and funneling people to a website or whatever, but is not necessarily as accessible from the outside to those public figures who might benefit you from a PR or a media standpoint.
I want to circle back to the word you use, zeitgeist, to kind of talk about, like, I feel like that is the magic moment that almost all entrepreneurs are trying to find, is essentially the right product market fix or the right content market fix, like what people are wanting to associate with. How do you, like, I guess, is there a way to successfully build a process around that and tap into that to leverage that? Or is it still just kind of like you just kind of get lucky with, you know, what's going on?
Yeah, there's like building blocks you can put in place to, I would say, increase your probability of being the receiver of that luck. I mean, I think it's undeniable any marketer who tries to say luck isn't a big part of it is lying. I mean, obviously, there's so many intersecting factors that have to kind of come into fruition for a brand to kind of reach that viral success. You know, I mean, it's part brand in itself, but kind of building like a cult following around a brand, like something like a Liquid Death is obviously the kind of quintessential example of that. And certain other brands have kind of come in underneath them over time. Like I know the kind of soda brand Olipop has been able to develop a pretty strong cult following in recent years. And then, you know, there's various categories where brands kind of through just amazing branding have been able to accomplish a lot of that, what you would call like moment in the zeitgeist of that category. So part of it's like branding, and part of it's obviously having a good product. Like, you know, the thing that you're putting out there, it has to be a value add to somebody's life, whether that's, you know, health wise or taste wise or, you know, something that's like adding to their routine or whatever that, or it's just funny and entertaining, like something that's great in that way. Then obviously the flip side of that has got to be different than what other people are doing. Like everybody knows, I brought up Wendy's earlier because in early 2017, they were the first brand to go nationally viral through roasting people on Twitter. And that whole like sassy, snarky personality. And at the time, that was still like, there were brands that were doing that, but not at that level. So then it was still this like novel thing that tons of brands were trying to cash in with. And, you know, it's still a way to cash in. Like you can still go viral, quote unquote, for snarky comments on Twitter and other platforms, but it's lost so much of its novelty since that moment in 2017. And it's super similar to right now on TikTok. You know, you've got Duolingo, the owl, who's kind of like this, they call the personification like very unhinged, you know, and it does a lot of horny content on TikTok of kind of like thirsting after celebrities and that type of thing. And it's gone super viral for them over the past year. And, you know, other brands have been really heavily tapping into that strategy the past like 6 or 8 months. And it's still got some life to it, but there's just continuing to be this diminishing return where people, as the type of content gets saturated, you know, the return gets less and less. So, you know, that's another part of it is trying to figure out, like, from your brand's perspective, what is novel enough to be distinctive and disruptive within that category. And then a lot of it is just time and energy spent like building out the kind of, like I said, the building blocks to tap into those moments when they come. Cause you might have the perfect brand for like there was this moment for an example, there was a moment in 2018, it was during the eclipse when the brand Moon Pie went viral on Twitter because it was right during the eclipse and Hostess did like some eclipse tweet being like, we're the official snack of the eclipse. And then Moon Pie, which is like literally named after the moon, shaped like a moon, they quote tweeted Hostess saying, LOL, okay. That was it. It was like, you know, 2-word tweet. And then that went mega viral. It was covered in tons of huge publications. And largely you can make the argument, like, you know, we'll never know this, hindsight 2020, but you can make the argument that that moment wouldn't have gone viral if they hadn't already developed a strong enough user base following them up to that point that then kind of got the initial traction behind it. And then that kind of snowballed into the mainstream. Like if they were a really small brand that didn't really have a big following at the time, that tweet could have just gone out and then never gone anywhere. But the fact that they had that foundation laid, it prepared them for that viral moment. So I think that piece of it can't be understated, which is that you just have to have time built in to any account of developing that loyal audience and that content strategy so that when those moments come, you know, you can really take advantage of them. So those are all kind of like a few of, I think, the main intersecting variables. And then, like you said, obviously, there's a lot of luck involved, too.
Yeah. One of my most successful tweets, I got ratioed on. And when I wrote it in my typical way, which is I tend to be like a generally agreeable person. I'm not a bridge burner or anything like that. I like people. I don't like pissing people off. But I'm like, you know what? I think like Twitter prefers something more divisive. So my tweet was like, it's rude for you to ask people to take shoes off at your house. And like people, of course, interpreted that I would wear shoes in their house. If someone wants me to take their shoes off, I'll take them off. But anyways, like that touched a nerve for a lot of people. Ended up being screenshotted and posted on like Oprah Winfrey's Instagram and just like, wow. You know, of course I got called a racist and, you know, everything that could happen from it. And it's like, I was really proud of it, even though I got ratioed and was negatively received, because it was like, if I said it in my normal way, where, you know, I was accommodating and, you know, had all my softening statements, it wouldn't have gone anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the strategy that you have to have on Twitter? Is you have to be divisive? You have to kind of draw a line in the sand?
Well, we're seeing that with Radio Shack right now. I mean, Radio Shack's been posting, again, this kind of super derogatory and horny content, which they're doing very transparently just for that kind of outrage farming engagement. And it's really tough to say because like you're saying, I mean, you can't deny that Twitter as a platform and as a culture incentivizes that kind of divisive content. I mean, Trump was the kind of like main character of Twitter for his entire presidency and a little bit before that, where, you know, he puts a tweet out there and then it becomes this gravitational pull and, you know, people love it or hate it. And either way, they jump in, they have to say something. Currently, obviously, Elon Musk kind of holds that title on the platform as well. And it's just, it's tough to say because, you know, as a brand, in today's environment, I feel like if you were to rewind 10 years ago, so much of what flies today as part of like marketing strategy and quote unquote good branding is totally in the face of everything that was kind of conventional 10 years ago, you know? And it's like right now, like taking a stand on issues and being more polarizing is kind of the norm within different like political movements and ideas and different ideological comments in general. Like you see brands all the time talking about anything from weed to racial justice to specific events in the news. Like I remember, I forget which brand it was, made a comment. They were, you know, denouncing the Capitol riots last year. Like really just things that you just would never in the past have thought a brand would ever want to touch. You know, they're much more likely to just jump in now. So it's tough for me to give like a sturdy answer because now that conventional wisdom is being kind of put on its head, you've got like this big, what used to be like the brands wanted as much of the pie as they could. You would think like, okay, our potential market, let's say it's 100 people, you know, we're striving for our content to reach as close to 100 people as possible. I think now across platforms, a lot of brands have settled into the fact that they're never going to reach those 100 people, but they can reach 25 or 40 insanely loyal people if they go into that polarizing content. So they'll just settle for that and then hope that they can kind of build out from there. So they're going to say, all right, screw the other like, you know, 50 or 70% of the market share that we could go after. Let's get this like super loyal 25 to 40% of it. And then over time, as we kind of build this out, more people will kind of naturally flock to it. We can kind of grow into whatever that potential looks like. So it's really tough to give like a blanket statement on it. I feel like it depends on the product and the type of brand that's marketing itself. But I do think you can't deny that polarizing content is super successful. But like I'm mentioning, like the kind of recent trend of horny content on social media going viral, especially within the past year, that type of content is really cheap and really gimmicky. And I think has a really short lifespan in the sense that like in 5-10 years, people are going to look back on that and be like, man, that sucked. Like that was just like really weird and lame and didn't have like a lasting like brand value in any way. Like it didn't really add anything to people's lives. It was just really this shocking kind of stunt that brands were participating in because they knew they could farm engagement from people. So, you know, a lot of brands, like I said, they've kind of hit the point where they're saying, you know what, screw it. We're afraid of irrelevancy. You know, we're afraid of kind of falling behind the curve with this stuff. Let's take some chances. Let's get polarizing. Let's get weird. But I think a lot of more mature brands are not necessarily getting away from that, but they're more cognizant of the potential pitfalls of it. And they're a little bit more careful to navigate it just for like their own longevity and consistency's sake. So I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with taking chances. There's nothing wrong with doing gimmicks once in a while. But I definitely think there's something to be said about good, consistent brand building over time. And if something like acting horny or being for a political movement is so important to the brand that they want to like cash in on it at a moment, I would say like then if that's the case, it should be important enough to become actually part of the brand identity. Like, if it's something that you care about so much that you're willing to risk that much by tapping into like a moment in the zeitgeist, make that part of what the brand does over the next 3 to 5 years and actually build it out to a point where like people can look at and they're not just saying, oh, they're just jumping on a bandwagon or trying to do a gimmick, you know, then it has actually some lasting value and doesn't feel like a just cheap one-off. So I don't know. Like I said, blanket statements are tough, but that's kind of my general thought on the ecosystem.
I think one of our biggest challenges these past 2 years was, I don't know if you remember this or not, it was on Instagram, there's this like blackout where everyone was to post a black image.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was one of these things where it was no longer like, oh, he posted, you know, like this symbol, he's supporting this. It was, if you don't post it, you're against it.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was just like this intense pressure forcing brands to choose a side. And, you know, historically, our brand, Beard Brand, has been apolitical. We don't want to get into politics. It's not something that we believe in. And, you know, I felt like we were put in between a rock and a hard spot. How do you suggest brands kind of handle situations like that if they ever arise again?
You just have to, like, I mean, it's easier said than done, I guess, especially in those moments where, you know, you're met with conflicting public pressures, but like you really do have to look internally at the brand ethos and like what the team and what the story stands for. And like I said, you have to figure out for yourself, is this something that we're willing to, if we're going to cash in on it, is it something that we're willing to actually, you know, really buy into and like fulfill over a period of time and not just like this one-off moment? Because I think that's the perfect example is that the blackout thing where like, you know, during BLM's kind of early moments, not as a movement, but as like a viral movement in 2020 after George Floyd, you had a lot of brands cash in on that. And then they would do it for like a week or a few weeks. And then as it kind of like dissipated, they would just kind of slowly remove them. And there was never really like any kind of announcement or transparency around like, were they doing anything for Black Lives Matter? Was it just kind of this like performative thing that they were trying, like you're saying, kind of keep public pressure off of them? So they just wanted to kind of appease people. And I think, yeah, almost every big brand wrestled with that exact conundrum. And I think it was an impossible task because on one hand, you had people doing the kind of like silence is violence talking point where they would be like, you know, if you're not participating in this, you're against us. And then on the flip side of it, you had people saying when brands were doing this, that it was just performative activism. It was a rainbow capitalism. You know, it's just brands cashing in on this social justice movement. So like I said, I really think that, you know, the only way to really navigate it is either doing what you're saying, which is kind of steering clear, like act as if it's not there, you know, whether that's, you know, going silent for a week or a little while to kind of like wait till the moment the pressure passes a bit, or whether that's going all in and saying, okay, you know, we've as a brand kind of evaluated our values and our story, and we do believe this is kind of a moment or a piece we want to kind of bring on board our general marketing moving forward. Because if you don't do that, then it's just kind of like, you know, people have all the ammunition they need in the future to kind of like to reference back to that moment and be like, well, yeah, they just kind of jumped on this opportunity. And you're never gonna, it's like I don't like the cancel culture term because it's kind of just been weaponized in political discourse. But I think as a phenomenon, like obviously it's impossible to deny that there's a very strong social movement in certain corners of the internet to kind of like shout down and like call out, you know, different people and businesses or whatever. And I think that is just going to continue to be there as people coalesce around small, like as the world gets smaller, essentially, you know, platforms, everything kind of becomes more centralized, people's voices get louder and louder. So I think it's all part of just navigating that and like making sure that, you know, on one hand, you're crossing your T's, dotting your I's as to what you're saying and how you're acting on it. But on the other hand, really just standing true to your brand values and not just like giving into a mob because that's like in the moment, it feels like something you've got to do to ease up some pressure, you know?
I want to shift this towards working with an agency. So somebody doesn't want to hire someone in-house or they don't have these abilities. How do they go about finding the right person to work with, whether it be like a freelancer or an agency? What are the things to look out for? And kind of like, can you guide them through that?
It's, oh man, that's a huge can of worms. I don't know how deep we want to get into that. It's really tough these days because the way social media marketing in general has kind of blown up the past 5 or so years, there's just so many charlatans out there. I mean, like navigating across platforms, you know, everybody's familiar with like the kind of get rich quick schemes that you get ads on YouTube for and TikTok, where it'll be like, you know, you're a social media manager and all you need to do is like, you want to make like $1 million a month. You just got to sign up for this service and do these postings and blah, blah, blah. And like that stuff is everywhere now. And like, there's so many of these boutique agency startup types that have been just been popping up every year all over the place with these small teams promising big numbers. And they've all got super similar websites and ways of presenting themselves as like professional, and like, they'll tout numbers that you can't really verify. And it can be really tough to navigate like what's real and what's not. I mean, as the kind of like boring industry answer, it's just going with credible agencies. It's just looking for agencies that have like on the books done certain work that you can check on, that you can, you know, just make sure that it's, you know, they've been around for 5+ years and they've got like a good track record, a good rapport with the clients that they've worked with. Those are the kind of basics. But from that point, you just have to figure out what your goals are as a brand. Like specifically, are you looking to build out a kind of cult following organically on like a Twitter or a TikTok? All right, then you got to like start looking up agencies that have done that for other brands. Like start thinking about like the brands that you know from social media that have kind of done that over the years. And then, you know, trace back if there was an agency behind them that helped drive that support. It's not always an agency. Sometimes it's an in-house person, like the Slim Jim Instagram account, which has just exploded the past couple of years. That was made viral by this guy, Andy Hines, who was actually a comedian, that he ran a parody Slim Jim account. I think it was in like 2019, I want to say. And that parody account ended up like blowing up past Slim Jim's account. So they just ended up hiring the guy. And then he came on and he brought his whole like kind of meme audience along, and it just worked perfectly. He actually tragically passed away, I think it was last year, really sad, really young guy. But that was like, you know, Slim Jim to this day, I mean, even after his passing, like they continue to explode on Instagram. And they're an example of, you know, that was just a single guy that came on, was able to take them from like, I think they were under 100,000 followers when he came on, and then he took them over 1 million. So, and that was all organic, just like kind of cult follower growth, you know? So it's really about like finding whatever category, if it's like a QSR or CPG style category brand you're with, like finding the all-stars that you're a fan of in that category, then looking up the origins and see like, where did this, you know, story kind of emerge? Like who is the person or the agency behind it? And then looking into that. And then if you're not going to go with the person or the agency that necessarily did that story, maybe you can't afford them or whatever, you just look for comparable people or agencies in that space and try to, you know, do some vetting as you can. But it's difficult to navigate, I'll say that.
Yeah. What are current rates for that? You know, like,
Agency rates can range from probably like the lowest you'd get is, I mean, it's really small ones. Maybe they go as low as 100, but I would say probably 115 an hour tends to be like the lowest. Average could be 130 to 140 ish. And then on the high end, maybe 150 up, depending on the agency. And then they all bundle that differently. Like if they're trying to do like retainer or project-based work. I mean, based on like proposals that I've put together and competitively talked with peers of mine over the past few years, you know, to have like a good social strategy, depending on like how the hours are allocated, you know, you're looking at minimum, at like the kind of baseline for maintenance and maybe some potential small growth for a platform over time, you're looking at a minimum of like 4,000 to 6,000 a month, I would say. And that's, again, variable on the person or the agency, depending on what they could do with that. If you're looking for like aggressive growth, you're looking 10 grand plus, I would say. And again, totally depends. It's usually broken down by hours. So like if you're trying to blow up on TikTok, TikToks take longer to produce than tweets. So, you know, it can kind of break down a little differently.
Are you doing any freelance work?
Yes. Yeah. I'm currently doing a bit of freelance in the past. I've done a lot of like tech company freelance before through Google and YouTube, and then also some startup stuff. I took the CBD gummy brand, Not Pot. I took their Twitter account from 0 to like 5,000 a couple years ago. So I've done a little bit here and there, and I'm dipping my toes in again right now. But I also work full time for an ad agency during the day. So like a lot of what I do, you know, I'll jot ideas down and I can maybe do some emails during the day, but I'll do like content docs where like I'll just kind of, or like they call them content buckets, where it'll be like, you know, I'll work on like a big document to kind of drop maybe once a week to a client, where I'll do like evening community management or strategy and stuff on the weekends. So it's not a full-time gig for me.
Yeah. Where can people follow you, reach out to you?
It's just my name. So I don't know if I'm the only Nathan Auerbach, but I'm the only one with a strong online presence. So you can at Nathan Auerbach on any platform. And then it's just nauerbach@auerbach.com for email.
And how do you spell your last name?
It's A-L-L-E-B as in boy, A-C-H. It's very German.
Yeah, man. That's how we roll around here. All right. This has been another e-commerce conversations. Hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. Social media is the bee's knees. Of course, find us on Twitter. We're over there tweeting all the time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, man.
Cheers. Keep on growing.